I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. The election is 3 weeks from today. Do I hear you cheering? While Pennsylvania has been described as a battleground state, Hillary Clinton has taken a big lead in recent weeks. Donald Trump has made several speeches about voter fraud in the Commonwealth, claiming if he loses, it proves the election is rigged. Here's what he said.
You've got to go out and you've got to get your friends and you've got to get everybody you know. And you got to watch your polling booths, because I hear too many stories about Pennsylvania, certain areas. I hear too many bad stories, and we can't lose an election because of you know what I'm talking about. So go and vote and then go check out areas, because a lot of bad things happen. And we don't want to lose for that reason. We don't want to lose, but we don't want to lose for that reason. So go over and watch carefully.
We asked Charlie Giroux to join us to talk about how Trump's strategy is playing out in Pennsylvania and where it has left Republican Senator Pat Toomey, who's being challenged by Democrat Katie McGinty. Toomey said at last night's debate with McGinty he'll probably announce whether or not he'll endorse Donald Trump before November 8th. Charlie Giroux is CEO of the public relations and issue advocacy firm called Quantum Communications, based in Harrisburg. He's a conservative columnist. And Charlie, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Always nice to be with you, Marty.
Let me quote something that Al Schmidt said yesterday. He's a Republican member of the city commissioners here in Philadelphia. He said the real threat to the integrity of elections in Philadelphia isn't voter fraud, although it does rarely occur. It isn't even Russian hackers, though they may certainly exist. The real threat to the integrity of elections is irresponsible accusations that undermine confidence in the electoral process. Is Donald Trump hurting our democracy?
By saying those things, yes, he is. I think that what Senator Toomey said last night and what Commissioner Schmidt said as well pretty well hit the nail on the head, Marty. Our election system is flawed. It's not perfect. None in the world is. But it has integrity, and it is legitimate, and it needs to be recognized by everybody that believes in the rule of law. Otherwise, the system literally falls apart.
But it does seem to appeal to some of Trump's base, this idea about fraud, and specifically fraud here in Philadelphia. Some are wondering whether this is kind of a dog whistle, because it's a not largely, but certainly has the lion's share of African-American voters in the Commonwealth.
Well, we have had voter fraud in Philadelphia, Marty. Let's be honest about that. In fact, we had an election overturned not that long ago because of voter fraud. But having said that, I go back to the point I made just a moment ago, which is the legitimacy of our electoral process can't be questioned ultimately, because if it is, the whole system falls apart. And it's really, in my judgment, a travesty that Mr. Trump has chosen to make this his article of faith going into the election 3 weeks hence. It really is. I don't think it's good for the system. I don't think it's good for the country. And frankly, I don't think it's true.
Why do you think he's doing it? I know you're not his psychologist,
no,
and you can't get in his head. But he said this several times.
He
said this several times, and he focuses specifically on Pennsylvania.
Well, I mean, I'm sure that there are people feeding him stories that have come out of Philadelphia over the past few years. And frankly, you know, there have been some things, and Al Schmidt's been one of the people that uncovered them, that have not been good in the electoral process in Philadelphia. But again, we cleaned up our house and, you know, have done everything that that should have been done to make sure that the process has integrity, is legitimate, et cetera. And again, I can't get into Donald Trump's head. I don't want to speculate on why he's doing it. But I think it is fair to say that others have made very, very important light of the fact that this is not something that people that are winning elections generally say.
This does put Senator Toomey into what appears to be a very awkward situation, which he has criticized Donald Trump in some of his ads, but he is at this point not willing to endorse him or not endorse him. Why do you think Toomey is so reluctant to say to say who he would support or whether he would support Donald Trump.
Because Pat Toomey is running for the United States Senate. He's not running for president. He's running on his record, not on somebody else's. He's running on his vision for the future, not another candidate's. And he wants to focus on his own race. And frankly, that's what he should do. And those in the media that keep clamoring for who are you for? I don't hear them asking, who are you for attorney general? Who are you going to vote for state treasurer? Who do you support for auditor general? There's only one thing, and it's clearly the only issue that Katie McGinty thinks she has.
But we're talking about someone in the U.S. Senate, one of the three branches of government. Yes, they're one of 100, but they do have a particular kind of power and authority.
Sure. So, what's the point, Marty? His vote in the voting booth is private. His vote on the floor of the U.S. Senate is very public, and it should be. That's what we ought to be talking about. The votes that he's made on the floor of the United States Senate, which have been good for Pennsylvania, good for the country, well respected by the voters, and that's why Pat Toomey is going to win on November the 8th.
But I'm wondering whether there aren't some political calculations here and whether he is worried about angering perhaps Trump supporters that are considering voting for Toomey and trying to figure out how to bring in women that we know are so critical to elections and trying to how to appeal to both sides that probably don't agree with each other on Donald Trump.
Well, I know you love to speculate, Marty.
I do love to speculate.
You do love to speculate, and your speculation may or may not be correct. But this much I do know. It's a fact that Pat Toomey has a record in the United States Senate. It's one that he is proud to defend. It's one that is one that's been very, very good for the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, the people here. He's had a good working relationship with his counterpart, Senator Bob Casey, a Democrat, and that's worked out well for the people of Pennsylvania. He has a clearly articulated vision for our future, and that's what he's going to campaign on, not who's at the top of the ticket. I mean, if Katie McGinty wants to spend the rest of the campaign defending Hillary Clinton and her actions, let her.
Does winning Pennsylvania, though, and perhaps this is more, well, for Toomey, but also for Trump or Clinton, depend on the collar counties, as they are called, these counties outside of Philadelphia?
They're very important for Pat Toomey, and they're vital for Donald Trump. I mean, Donald Trump is not doing well, as you know, Marty, in the southeastern part of the state right now. And to be very candid, I don't see what is likely to change that at this juncture. But Pat Toomey is doing well there. And again, he's doing well because he has established a strong record as somebody that gets things done in Washington, D.C., where others don't. And so I think that it's his record that is ultimately going to take him across the finish line. And, you know, we'll see what happens with Mr. Trump in those so-called collar counties.
Help us understand the support that Trump has in what appears to be the southwest part of the state. I think people living here, although if you drive around the suburbs here, you see plenty of Trump signs and you see plenty of Clinton signs. But it seems that Trump's support, base of support, is in the southwest part of the state. What is his appeal there?
Well, his appeal there is overwhelming, and it's largely socioeconomic, Marty. I mean, these are many, many of them Democrats who are voting against Hillary Clinton because of coal, because of natural gas, because of steel, because of the economy, and because of their own concerns about their economic future. These are Democratic counties, traditional Democratic strongholds in point of fact, where Mr. Trump is doing very, very well in the southwestern part of the state. But as you've correctly pointed out, it's counterbalanced by a fairly dismal showing that he has thus far anyway in Philadelphian suburbs.
What do you think he can? I don't realize, you don't work for him, do you? Do you, Charlie?
I supported another candidate in the primary, as you know. I was,
yes,
Carly Fiorina's national co-chairman and very proud to have done that. But Mr. Trump was not my first choice.
So what do you think, and looking ahead to the final debate, which, of course, is Wednesday night, what do you anticipate will happen? And of course, we're in this speculative situation here.
Well, I'm not sure, but I sadly don't think that we're going to see anything markedly different from the second debate, which was, you know, a free-for-all, and I think left many, many voters scratching their heads about whether or not this is the best we can do. And I just frankly don't think you're going to see anything dramatically different on Wednesday night. I think Mr. Trump has dug in his heels on his message. It's a message that appeals to his base, but bluntly doesn't have much extension beyond that. Mrs. Clinton can't defend her record on emails, and she doesn't even try anymore. That's going to be brought up as an issue again and again on Wednesday night, and I don't think that you're going to hear anything differently. So I think that, you know, an awful lot is, as they say, baked into the pie at this point. Voters will be tuning in on Wednesday night, many of them having made up their mind, and they're really just to root for the candidate that they support.
Do you think there'll be a big voter turnout, regular voter turnout, less than normal voter turnout?
I think there's going to be a big turnout. This is a election where there's a lot of emotion on both sides, Marty. There's a lot of nose-holding and a lot of folks that aren't happy and find both choices pretty unpalatable. But there still is a lot of interest in this election, frankly, because there's a lot of interest in the future of our country, and that is a very good thing.
Let me read a comment. We got a lot of comments here. Let me just read the first one from David. He says, when will this campaign stop shooting itself in the face every other day, energizing the base, doesn't get more votes when the antics of the campaign repel people from it? And I think embedded in that comment or that question, Charlie, is Donald Trump hurting the Republican Party?
There are a lot of Republicans, as you know, Marty, that are very frustrated with Donald Trump. Let me give you one quick look at this.
Sure.
I call it the 90-80-70 rule. Ordinarily, a Republican candidate needs to get 90% plus of the Republican vote. John McCain got 90%, and he lost pretty badly. Mitt Romney got about 93%, and he still lost. Barry Goldwater, in the landslide election of 1964, got roughly 82 or 83% of the Republican vote. Donald Trump is still running in the 70s among the base Republican vote. I mean, that's an area where he must absolutely improve. And in particular, with college-educated whites, a voting bloc that no Republican candidate for president has ever lost. And that's where Mr. Trump is failing in the Philadelphia suburbs, especially among women, where he's minus 20-plus to Mrs. Clinton at this point.
With 3 weeks to go, is there anything he can say or do to get himself into that 80 or 90% category?
There is, but, you know, to be very candid, right now he's not doing it. He's got to get away from the ad hominems. He's got to get away from the freewheeling that he loves to do. He's got to get away from this, you know, the voting system is all rigged and it's fraudulent and not legitimate, et cetera, and start talking about what he would do to get the economy moving again, because it is stagnant. There's no question about that. You know, the Obama administration has failed us in many, many ways on the economy. And he has to talk about a specific plan to get the economy jump-started and moving again, and a specific plan to deal with ISIS. If he can do those things effectively and cohesively, coherently, and articulately over the course of the next couple of weeks, he still has a serious opportunity to pick up those Republican votes, because the one thing I can tell you, Marty, is there's not a one of them that thinks highly of Hillary Clinton.
We're going to end on that note. Charlie Giroux, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
It's always nice to be with you.
Nice to have you with us as well, Charlie. And he's the CEO of the public relations issue advocacy firm Quantum Communications, based in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. He is a conservative columnist. And we're going to take a very short break, and then we'll be talking more about what Trump has said about women, but about what women have said about Trump and what that says about our electoral system and our race for the White House this year. We have Mona Charon from National Review and Rebecca Traister from New York Magazine. Stay with us. Much more after this very short break. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. The Access Hollywood hot mic video of Donald Trump bragging about forcing himself on unsuspecting women is still reverberating today. So far, 9 women have come forward claiming that Donald Trump had sexually assaulted them. Trump has denied the allegations and gone one step further, making fun of the physical appearance of some of his accusers, including his rival, Hillary Clinton.
The only way they figure they can slow it down is to come up with people that are willing to say, oh, I was with Donald Trump in 1980. I was sitting with him on an airplane. And he went after me on the plane. Yeah, I'm going to go after. Believe me, she would not be my first choice, that I can tell. You don't know. That would not be my first choice.
And she said, I made inappropriate advances. Take a look. You take a look. Look at her. Look at her words. You tell me what you think. I don't think so. I don't think so. But I'm standing at my podium, and she walks in front of me, right? She walks in front of me, you know? And when she walked in front of me, believe me, I wasn't impressed. But she walks in front of me.
Donald Trump claims Bill Clinton has said worse things than he has, and he's criticized the former president for his sexual misconduct. Melania Trump was interviewed by CNN's Anderson Cooper last night, calling her husband's comments boy talk and saying he's the victim of a coordinated attack between the news media and the Clinton campaign. The last and final presidential debate is on Wednesday night. We asked Mona Charon to join us. She's a syndicated columnist, a political analyst. She writes for the National Review, also a senior fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center. Mona Charon, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Nice to be back, Marty. Thanks.
You're welcome. Also with us is Rebecca Tracer. She's writer-at-large for New York Magazine, wrote a book called Big Girls Don't Cry and all the Single Ladies, Unmarried Women, and the Rise of an Independent Nation, just out in paperback. And Rebecca Tracer, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times as well.
It's always great to be here, Marty.
Rebecca, let me begin with you, but Mona, I certainly want to hear from you as well. It's so curious to me that Donald Trump has done to his accusers what he accused Hillary Clinton doing to the accusers of Bill Clinton, which is, to denigrate them, to make fun of them. Just how dangerous, Rebecca Tracer, do you think this is?
Dangerous for Donald Trump?
Yes.
Well, it's dangerous if he's worried about his standing with women voters, which is plummeting. And that seems to be happening. The polling is so hard to read. And I think it's hard to make guesses about. But he is in sharp decline with women voters, according to at least most of the polls that I've seen recently. So, and given that women make up such a huge share of the electorate, I think it is extremely dangerous for him on November 8th. However, it doesn't surprise me, and it's not out of character for him. I mean, this is sort of perfectly matched with the kind of cartoon version of boorish white masculinity that Donald Trump stands for and that seems to gratify his base. So it doesn't surprise me that he's doing this. It fits perfectly with the character that his voters seem to like.
Mona, what do you think the appeal is, and what do you say to Rebecca Tracer's comments?
Well, I'm tempted to ask for a cup of hemlock right now and just get this over with.
You're not alone in that, just so you know, Mona.
This has been the worst political year in my lifetime. I am dismayed and horrified by what the Republican Party I used to belong to has made of it. It's beclowned itself this year by nominating this lout, buffoon, and really rather vicious character. So, all of that said, right. I think it was not necessary, though, for Rebecca to say this is typical of white males. I mean, it is typical of some males of all races, but not necessarily particular to white people. I think that the tendency to group people that way is part of what's wrong with Trump, and it's certainly part of what's wrong with the left.
Let me give you.
I want to clarify that I wasn't suggesting that this was all white men. I was talking specifically about Donald Trump's. Because, as we know, his emphasis in how he talks about people has to do with both the way he talks about women and the way that he talks about immigrants and people of color. So that's why he included white male in reference to Donald Trump, not to all white men.
Okay, oh, fair enough. Go ahead,
Mona. I understand. Let's just stipulate that Donald Trump treats everyone horribly and with disrespect, and that he is a model for exactly how not to conduct private or public relations with other people. But I cannot help but to point out the hypocrisies on both sides. So I'll start with the side that, as I say, I used to belong to, the Republican Party, and I will say that the hypocrisy here is off the charts. People who were telling us when Bill Clinton was president that character was king, that character mattered, that this kind of sexual misbehavior was disqualifying and disreputable and so forth, are now saying, it's boy talk, it's locker room talk, everyone does it, it's no big deal, and let's not forget how terrible Hillary is. So that's their hypocrisy. But don't forget that the left, during the 90s, they had been very, very concerned about sexual harassment. They went after Clarence Thomas and others for naughty language, for bad comments, and so forth. And you know that. But when the target was Bill Clinton, when Bill Clinton was revealed to have done terrible things, they suddenly said, "Well, it's no big deal, and we can overlook this." And oh, but the Republicans. So. I'm plague on both your houses.
Well, Rebecca, I'm curious about your response to that comment, which is a bit of hypocrisy on both sides. And going back to the 90s, certainly members of the Clinton campaign, I guess, at that point, talked about bimbo eruptions. They talked about nuts and sluts.
Yeah.
Is there some degree of hypocrisy here?
Well, I think there is a degree. I myself have written, I agree with Mona, that feminists in particular were in a real bind during the Clinton administration because there had been this, after the Anita Hill hearings, this sort of entrance into the lexicon of this notion of sexual harassment, the idea that what had for a long time been considered typical male behavior within workplaces was actually behavior that was damaging to women as a class. And then you wound up with Bill Clinton, and feminists did. Many of them twisted themselves in knots. And I think there is a reasonable conversation to be had. I think, you know, we have the way in which we talk about sexual power imbalances has shifted radically, not just over the past 25 years, but in the past 5 years. I think we've developed all kinds of new sharp ways of looking at sexual power imbalances, and that they absolutely would cast Bill Clinton in a more negative light. And I think that we do have there. It's absolutely worthwhile having a left conversation, a feminist conversation, reevaluating Bill Clinton. I am all for that. However, I think that there is total false equivalency when you suggest that a revisiting of Bill Clinton's sexual impropriety in any way has bearing on whether Hillary Clinton the way that she's competing with Donald Trump, who himself right now is not only accused of past sexual impropriety, but is out there right now behaving in exactly the same ways, accusing the women who are making accusations of him of being not attractive enough to assault. I mean,
it's beyond belief.
Hillary Clinton is the candidate. Bill Clinton is not the candidate. And so I think to suggest that there is equivalent hypocrisy is wrong.
Monique, go ahead.
Yeah, so I'll grant that. I think the I was talking about advocates on the left and on the right, and my point is there's enough hypocrisy to go around on both sides. You know, the people who support Trump and the people who supported Clinton being willing to overlook this kind of disgusting behavior if it happens on their own their own preferred candidate. Okay, that much having been said, you're right.
Well, hold on. Go ahead, Mona. Go ahead, Mona. And Rebecca, we'll get back to you. Go ahead, Mona.
Yeah, Hillary Clinton is the victim here in a certain way. It was she was the wife. She was not the sexual harasser. I think most women know other women who have had similar situations in their lives and are not so quick to say, as I hear some people saying, that the woman, you know, that Hillary Clinton is just as guilty of this, that they were a team. You know, I think most people look at it and think, well, no, she was not equally culpable. She may have said some nasty things about some of the women who accused her husband, but that's in a different category from Bill's misbehavior.
Rebecca, let me toss something out here. And I mentioned Melania Trump being interviewed by Anderson Cooper last night, and she seemed to be talking about a left-wing conspiracy, a coordinated attack between the news media and the Clinton campaign, of course, reminds us of what Hillary Clinton said back in the 1990s. But what do you make of that?
Oh, God, I make of it that it's terrible to be a political wife, and that it's terrible to be married to men who engage in sexual misbehavior and then to be brought out and asked to pay the bill for it. That's part of what I make of it, as far as both of them go. You know, one of the things that I don't think there's a conspiracy. I mean, I don't think that the media is operating. I don't think the media, even the media that is purported to be liberally sympathetic, has ever been in cahoots with Hillary Clinton. I think that the media has for 25 years now been extremely hard on Hillary Clinton. and that has continued through this election. So I certainly, you know, don't get behind any notion that the Clinton campaign is working in cahoots with the media. There is tremendous enmity between the Clinton campaign and the media. However, you know, I also don't want to sit around and condemn Melania anymore. I mean, she's married to this guy, and I don't, you know, I don't agree with what she said last night. I hated the way that she talked about men as children and sort of excused their behavior. I think at one point she said, you know, I feel like I have two boys at home, my son and my husband. I mean, this is a very old way of excusing bad and often abusive male behavior, and just attributing to men characteristics of unruly children. And I didn't like the way that she spoke about it, but I also, again, don't think that she's the issue. She's not the candidate, and she is being put in a very precarious position as the wife who's being asked to stand in as the defense of her husband. It is a terrible position for wives to be put in.
Well, you know, Mona, not to be completely naive here, and Rebecca, your phone is not the greatest, but we're going to hang in there and hopefully get you on a better line. But could this be, I mean, after Clarence Thomas and Anita Hill, after Bill Clinton and Jennifer Flowers and Monica Lewinsky, and then what we're dealing with today, could this be a turning point where we finally begin to talk like adults about some of this stuff that you and I and Rebecca are talking about?
Well,
not to be naive here.
Yeah. First of all, we would, in order for that to happen, we would all have to be willing to talk about proper behavior for everyone, and not have double standards for whichever side. Now, and also, I just have to add one quick thing about Melania, which is that she was, in conscious or not, she was echoing exactly Hillary Clinton's defense of her husband on the Today Show when the Monica Lewinsky story broke. As you recall, she went on the Today Show and she said in response, these are unproven allegations. They will not be proven to be true, which turned out to be false. And she said there is a vast right-wing conspiracy that's behind this, when in fact it was just her husband's bad judgment. That was all it was. So she put herself in that position. He put her in that position. But we cannot avoid hearing the echoes in Melania of Clinton's performance all those years ago in Melania's performance the other night. Okay, can we begin to have an adult conversation? An adult conversation would be, I agree with Rebecca about this, that the notion that, you know, we should treat men like children and say that they're not responsible for their behavior or that sort of thing. No, certainly not. But everyone should be held to the same standard. And it isn't really a man versus woman issue. It is are we civilized human beings who respect one another, or are we not? And that's got to be the standard for all.
And that's Mona Charon. She's a syndicated columnist, a political analyst, and she writes for the National Review. Also with us, Rebecca Traister, writer at large for New York Magazine. And we are talking about, the race for the White House and the various allegations against Donald Trump. We've been talking a little bit about Bill Clinton as well, and about the role that women are playing. And you can join the conversation at 1-888-477-9499. A million comments here. Radio Times at WHYY.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me play, talk about a political wife. Let me play just a clip, just about 24 seconds of Michelle Obama delivering a speech. It was actually at a Hillary Clinton rally in New Hampshire last week regarding Trump's hot mic comments.
This was not just a lewd conversation. This wasn't just locker room banter. This was a powerful individual speaking freely and openly about sexually predatory behavior and actually bragging about kissing and groping women, using language so obscene that many of us were worried about our children hearing it when we turn on the TV.
Rebecca, is Michelle Obama in a category by herself on this issue?
Well, she has been giving voice to the feminist fury, the trauma, that speech last week was so necessary for so many women. And the fact that it was Michelle Obama giving it, Hillary Clinton could not have given that speech for a number of reasons. One, she's simply not as talented and inspiring a speaker as Michelle Obama. And that's true. She just doesn't have the same talents on the stump. Two, as we've already discussed, she is in something of a compromised position here. And three, and I mean that because she's married to a man who we know has a complicated sexual past himself and has abused his sexual power, certainly. Three, the candidate, and especially the first woman candidate for president, it is extremely difficult for her to make a compelling feminist case on her own behalf for a lot of complicated reasons. And so Hillary Clinton could not have given the kind of speech that Michelle gave last week. And that is actually all to the best, because Michelle has become one of the best political speakers I've ever heard in my lifetime. Her convention speech was a thing of perfection. It's also true that it matters, I believe, that Michelle Obama is not a white woman. Because so much of the conversation about assault, and especially when finally the media and the Republican Party turned on Donald Trump, was in response to comments and abuse that had been directed at white women. And of course, we know that it's not only white women who suffer and whose bodies are made vulnerable to assault, to lewd comments, to abuse. And I think that Michelle Obama speaking as a woman of color means a lot to this conversation and this election, which, as we know, has, as I said before, has not only been about gender, but has also been about race and racial intolerance within the Donald Trump campaign.
Mona, about a minute or so before our break here, I'd just be curious about your response to what Rebecca said and what Michelle Obama said last week.
Well, I agree that Mrs. Obama is a great speaker. She has really developed. She wasn't in 2008, but she has really, really improved. And I agree that she's a powerful speaker. And look, you know, she has an easy target. Let's face it. Donald Trump is like a spreading oil slick. And so he brings out the eloquence in lots of people. And good for her. But I would love to see some, as I said earlier, I would love to see some equivalent disdain for all of the men who abuse women and mistreat them, no matter whether they have an R or a D after their names.
Well, let's take that break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Mona Charon, as I mentioned before, a syndicated columnist, a political analyst. She writes for the National Review. She's also a senior fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center. Rebecca Traister is with us as well, writer-at-large for New York Magazine. Her book, All the Single Ladies, Unmarried Women, and the Rise of an Independent Nation, is now out in paperback. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation. We've got a lot of people that want to join us as well. Stay with us. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, having a lively and really fascinating conversation with our guest, Rebecca Traister, and with Mona Charon. Mona, let me ask you, and Donald Trump essentially began his campaign more than a year ago denigrating the service of John McCain, who, of course, was a prisoner of war for 5 years, basically saying, I like my prisoners who I like my veterans or my soldiers who weren't captured. I've always just wondered why that wasn't a bigger disqualifier than it certainly was a year ago. Do you understand?
Well, there was that. And by the way, he was a draft dodger himself, so you have to love that. He said that avoiding venereal disease in the 1970s was his personal Vietnam. So really, the despicableness of his comments really is hard to you can't overstate it. So but having said that, I do think that the ground was prepared for Trump a little bit by the terrible disillusionment that many people in America and in the Republican Party more particularly, although not exclusively, have about their leadership, about the press. There is certainly very, very strong press bias, and that has affected the Trump supporters. You know, it's a little bit of the boy who cried wolf phenomenon. You know, every Republican nominee, for as long as I can remember, has been decried by Democrats and also by many in the press who tend to lean Democrat as a terrible person, as a racist, as a criminal of some sort. I mean, Mitt Romney was, who's probably the most upright person ever to run for the office of the presidency, was portrayed as some kind of monster who gave people cancer, who tortured a dog, who bullied a fellow student when he was 14 years old. I mean, so Republicans have become inured to hearing bad descriptions of Republican candidates. Some portion, not all of them, but some portion just turn it off. They say, oh, well, they say that about all of them. Mm-hmm. They always say they're racist. They always say they're sexist. And so there's a little bit of the boy who cried wolf thing going on that they can't hear it now, even though this time there is a real wolf. And in addition, I think there was a tremendous amount of damage done by activists on the right, by right-wing talk radio, you know, conservotainment, who prepared the ground in the sense of portraying the Republican leadership and Republicans in Washington as being the true enemy, not the Democrats. And so when a candidate came along who said he was just going to burn it all down, they were ready for that message. They thought, you know, there's really nothing worth saving.
Well, let me give you a chance to respond to that, Rebecca, because you have talked about the Republican Party and its lead candidate, Donald Trump. Expand on that, on your perspective, if you would.
Yeah, well, I mean, I disagree with Mona very profoundly. I mean, I think that I certainly agree with her that there has been criticism of previous Republican candidates as having been offering more covert, more papered over sort of dog whistles about race and gender. I mean, Mitt Romney went in front of the NAACP and talked about if your friends just want free stuff, tell them to vote for Obama. Rick Santorum, who's run for president several times, gave a speech where he talked about not wanting to give stuff to black people, which he claimed he said blah people. Sarah Palin had all kinds of dog whistles about the real America versus Obama's America. And it is true that it was much more covered up and much more debatable. Are they talking about race? What is true is that Republican policy for some time has been very focused on cutting back social programs that benefit people of color. They have been very focused on reducing access to reproductive rights, to abortion access, and to contraceptive access for women. Very focused on limiting enacting voter registration limits that would limit the number of people of color who can vote in various states. So that their policies have been connected to a lot of this rhetoric that they've been credited with. I agree with Mona that in Trump, what we get is that's why I called him cartoonish before. No apology, no papering over. This is a man whose political career began in birtherism, the fundamentally racist delegitimization of our first black president by suggesting that he was not born in the United States. And Donald Trump sort of made his bones on that campaign at the beginning of the Obama administration. And that's how he became a real political actor in the Republican Party. And that kind of unapologetic approach to racism and also later to sexism is, I think, what his appeal was for those who selected him. And I know not the whole party did not want him. I do know that. And I respect that lots of the party did not choose to have Donald Trump as their candidate. But enough of them wanted that to get away from the dog whistles and the debatable instances of racism or sexism and just get the unapologetic brand. And that's what they got in Donald Trump.
Mona, do you think when you look at Donald Trump's past, it's clear that he certainly had more liberal positions in the past than he has today. Could he have run as a Democrat?
He still has more liberal positions today than he has conservative ones. He's not a conservative in any recognizable fashion at all. He's against entitlement reform. He's against free trade. He's against a strong international position with alliances. He thinks NATO is dispensable. I mean, you could go down. There's a very, very long list. But let me just push back on a couple of things that Rebecca said. First of all, I think you misrepresented Mitt Romney's speech to the NAACP. I thought it was the most magnificent speech that he gave all season in 2012. It was a beautiful speech, and it was about how his ideas and his policies would be far better for black America than the policies that the Democrats were peddling. And it was respectful, and it was good-humored, and he never said anything about the 47% in that speech. That was taken from a fundraiser. It was a completely different situation, and there was nothing racial about it. And and
free stuff.
So,
yeah.
So first, and then further, you know, you implied that that conservative or Republican ideas are basically just racism is more politely packaged, and that's completely unjust and untrue. The fact is that if you look at school choice, you know, what is the most important thing for inner city kids that can possibly break the cycle of poverty? You have to say it's education reform. And who has been backing education reform and choice programs? Republicans and conservatives. Who's been blocking them? Liberals and Democrats. So to say that, you know, what you did, I think, is completely unjust and wrong. Now, are there certain people in both parties who are racist? Obviously, yes. Did Trump use a lot of dog whistles and more, you know, openly racial appeals? Yes. But to try to tar the entire Republican Party with that is not right.
I know you have a response there, Rebecca. Let me get a couple of callers in, and there's some comments I want to read as well. We've got Renee from, looks like, Haddon Township. Renee, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty.
Hi there.
Thanks for having me on.
Sure, go ahead.
I just wanted to say I'm a 30-something-year-old voter and woman in this country, and listening to the audio that you played in the beginning of the show of Trump at his rally, just and the supporters, hearing them laughing and cheering on, is infuriating. I think the past week and a half, I dare say I feel like the media, the country, hasn't been hard enough on Trump. Talking about Bill Clinton, I understand people bringing that up, but as a voter, I'm more concerned with the character of our candidates right now, present day. And so I didn't know if your guests could comment on that, if they agree with that we're not being hard enough, if maybe they know they could comment to the reasons why, maybe.
Well, Renee, just a quick follow up here. What do you want the media or the press? What do you want journalists, reporters? What do you want them to either say or do?
Right. I don't know if it's necessarily their role, but I guess I would want them to maybe echo more of what I'm feeling, what I'm talking to other people who are feeling the same way. I think they are challenging him. I think it's more so not necessarily challenging him during this election, because I would agree with, I think that he they are doing what I would expect of them. I think it's more so in light of recent events. I feel like maybe I'm not sure exactly.
Okay, no, fair enough.
Like maybe he's getting off a little easy, defending himself and just not being held accountable as much as he should be for what is being accused.
Renee, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Rebecca, what do you say in response?
Well, I think that one of the things that we see happening in recent events are the media reporting on Donald Trump. It was David Fahrenthold who's published a series of incredible blockbuster stories about Trump, who got his hands on that video. And sort of now then Trump responded to the video, and we've had a contemporary news cycle since. But I agree with the charge that the media was very bad at covering Trump for a long time. There was a degree to which people believed him to be a joke, that he wasn't really going to be the candidate. And I think that a lot of newspapers, a lot of television networks, I am a member of the media, I would take the blame for this as well, did not take Donald Trump seriously enough as a candidate, because it just seemed so improbable that this guy could be the nominee. And so I agree that the media did not do a good enough job for a long time. However, I think that so much of what we've seen happen in the past couple of weeks is thanks to tremendous reporting. I mean, David Fahrenthold, as far as I'm concerned, is the journalist hero of this election in his reporting on Trump, not just on that video, but on his contributions to charities. There's also the New York Times that public got the copy of his taxes, which I think had a big impact. I think that we have seen the media sort of kick into gear once they realized how very real this was. So I think it is fair to say the media hasn't been hard enough on him in the past, but also that they're doing, lots of people are doing a tremendous job on him right now.
What's your take, Mona?
My take is two things. First, if you want to see the most devastating takedowns of Trump in all his iterations, and by the way, his disgusting behavior did not begin with the tapes about women. If you want to look back during the primaries, you could see him ridiculing a handicapped reporter. You know, that crossed a moral line for many of us. If you want to see him being taken down, read the conservative columnists and writers at National Review, who have been consistently outlining all of his many depredations over these past 15, 16 months. Second, the mainstream media not only did not take him seriously enough, as Rebecca says, during the primaries, they thought it was amusing. And not only did they think it was amusing, they thought it was remunerative. So the networks, because he was good for ratings, went live to his rallies and broadcast them unfiltered, giving him $3 billion worth of free media so that he didn't have to spend money himself. And then, you know, they also withheld their fire, in my judgment, thinking, oh, you know, if he were the Republican nominee, he'd be very weak and beatable. And so they held their fire and their investigative talents until it was a one-on-one matchup with Hillary Clinton. So I fault the press on many, many levels.
Rebecca, what I hear Mona saying is, you know, the press as kind of enablers of Donald Trump's candidacy.
Yeah, I mean, I will say Mona's right about what's been happening in the conservative press. And I would say that there is a similar thing that has been happening for a long time on the left and amongst feminist writers in opinion journalism. But that's slightly different from the kind of investigative reporting that we've seen really kick into gear in the past few months in the bigger newspapers. So I think opinion journalists on both left and right have been extremely critical of Trump for a long time. I should say that. I think she's right, too, about a lot of the television networks understanding that Trump meant ratings and, you know, going easy on him. And that was persistent. I mean, if you watched Matt Lauer's treatment of Donald Trump at that town hall that Trump and Clinton did, and Matt Lauer got a lot of criticism for it, as he should have, that was just about as toothless an interview as you could possibly imagine. And that was, what, 2.5 months before the general election. I think that NBC, you know, Jimmy Fallon had him on. I know he's not an investigative journalist, but he is an entertainment journalist. You see NBC being very invested in a Trump candidacy in ways that I think are very discomforting. I think television news and the amount of airtime that they gave this guy, you also saw how easy it was for a celebrity to manipulate news sources. He could call in and have the floor at any number of these on any number of these networks simply because he was willing to call in. And you also see, I mentioned before, the enmity between Hillary Clinton and the press, in part because she doesn't like talking to the press.
No.
She's not the person who calls in and chats and gets all the airtime. And so that's another dynamic you've seen playing out.
Well, we could go on. Let me read an email from Diana, and I'll put this to you, Mona Charon, just wondering what you want Chris Wallace to ask either Trump or Clinton on Wednesday night.
Oh, there's another debate, is there?
There is apparently another debate, yes. The final one, I'm told. But go ahead.
Oh, gosh. Well, I don't know. I mean, frankly, I think I probably speak for many in the view that we don't have anything new to learn from these two people anymore. We know as much as we need to know. We've seen them over the course of 30 years. Their characters and their positions are crystal clear. I cannot imagine that Chris Wallace could ask a magic question that would somehow make voters more educated than they have. They have abundant sources of information right now. So I'll watch the debate, but I don't expect anything new.
Rebecca, about 30 seconds. I mean, while emails and other things have gotten a fair amount of coverage, there are things that have not been talked about much this debate, election season. I'm thinking of things like climate change.
Yeah, climate change, the environment, certainly reproductive rights. You know, at this point, I think Donald Trump used to have a very different position on reproductive rights, but now he has taken a very strong anti-abortion position. That hasn't been talked about at any of the debates at any length, and climate change. I think those are the two things I would like to hear most. I'd also like to hear in more detail about immigration and, you know, which has gotten a lot of build a wall and deport people talk, but not any real conversation about what the policy would actually be. But certainly climate change and reproductive rights, but mostly I'm with Mona in that I think we know everything we need to know about these two at this point.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for joining us today in Radio Times and having a really interesting, lively, and important conversation. Rebecca Traister, thanks as always for joining us on Radio Times.
Thank you.
Writer at large for New York Magazine, Mona Charon, thank you for joining us as well.
My pleasure.
And she writes for the National Review. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times. You can find out much more about the program. In fact, you can carry on a conversation that we weren't able to do justice to in this hour. Lots of comments there as well. I'm Marty Moscoe. Thanks for joining us.